Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
I mean, basically, they would take anybody they could get because manpower was a real problem. They were desperate to get as many gunners through the school as possible. So you had not only British people, but you had people from the occupied countries such as Czechoslovakia, Poland, but you also had French, Norwegian, Dutch, people coming through, some Canadians, New Zealanders, but also coastal command. Some of the gunners would be hived off on coastal command squadrons, some like the short Sunderland.
Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson. Today we welcome back Graham Rendall. Although we featured Graham talking about unidentified aerial phenomena, I actually came across Graham while doing some of the research for our Coastal Command series. Graham has authored several books on Northumberland airfields and also about RAF Morpeth. Now, this was somewhere I knew very little about. So let's find out a little bit more. Graham, welcome back to Extended.
Hello, Peter. Thanks for inviting me back.
No, it's great to have you back on the show, Graham. And I wanted to find out a little bit more about aviation and some of the airfield stories up in the Northeast. Before we get going, how did you really get engaged in learning and understanding and writing some books about Northeast aviation?
I suppose I grew up in the northeast of England, in the, well, I suppose the county of Northumberland. From an early age, I was immersed in aviation. My mother bought me airfix kits of model aircraft to keep me quiet as a child of about 4 years old. And reading the instructions on those kits, I developed an interest in various types of aircraft and just wanted to learn more and more and more about the subject. And living very close to Newcastle Airport, aircraft were in the skies all the time, and if they weren't, then I was usually traveling to air shows at an early age as well, seeing air displays in the local area, and just reading pretty much anything I could get my hands on. So yeah, totally immersed in the subject. That's my background, basically.
So how did RAF Morpeth come across your radar then?
Funny enough, I have a dim memory of my father taking me up there when I was about 7 years old and walking along one of the old taxiways, which were still, you could still walk on them back then. Nowadays, they've all been fenced off by the farmers for insurance reasons. But back then, it was easy just to park the car on the side of the lane, which bisected one of the old taxiways, and literally just walk onto the airfield. There was no problem whatsoever. And it was used for heavy goods training back in the 70s. And I remember, you know, big wagons driving up and down, the drivers being trained what to do. So, yeah, it's a fairly early memory. But then, as most things happen, you take other interests up as a child, and everything's quite, you know, sort of transient. And it wasn't until much later on, when I started writing about local aviation events and airfields, etc., that I picked up an interest in finding out much more about Morpeth than was just like, oh, yeah, it's just an old airfield somewhere.
Okay, so Graham, look, for those of our listeners maybe who are not in the UK or don't understand the area, whereabouts is the airfield located?
So it's in the county of Northumberland, which is the most northerly county in England, and I was trying to work out a way of describing what Northumberland looks like. And if you can imagine a triangle with its sloping side running from the bottom left to the top right, that's what Northumberland looks like. And the bottom of the triangle is effectively the River Tyne or the Roman Wall, 2000 years ago, ran across that part of England. And then the sloping side's the Scottish border, and the other side of the triangle is the North Sea. So it's hemmed in on three sides, if you like. And Morpeth is towards the bottom sort of right-hand corner of that. It's about 15 miles north of the city of Newcastle, which is the major population centre in this part of the world. The rest of the county in Northumberland is fairly sparsely populated. A lot of it's moorland and hills, particularly along the Scottish border, and some of it's very, very remote with, you know, no roads at all. There's a big artillery range up there called Otterburn, which is also an army training range. But there were airfields situated there during the war and even beforehand. So it was a place where, obviously, the RAF had to defend airspace against potential attacks from the east and over the North Sea. Now, Morpeth itself, as I say, is 50 miles north of Newcastle. And the airfield, when it was built, was situated about a mile and a half to 2 miles southwest of the town of Morpeth, about a mile or so, maybe a mile and a half away from the East Coast Railway line, the main artery from London up to Edinburgh. So that gives you a general idea. It's fairly gentle countryside. It's farmland, fairly flat, a little bit of a slope. There's a little bit of undulation in the actual area itself, but ideal airfield construction site kind of thing.
So where did the idea, how did an airfield arrive on this spot? What was the history to actually bring the airfield about?
There'd already been a string of landing zone fields in the area during World War One, but that was mostly for like emergency landing sites, and also if they needed to maybe have aircraft dotted around the area for anti-Zeppelin raids. So there was one actually situated about a mile away from where they eventually built RAF Morpeth. So aviation is no real stranger to that area, but it was finding somewhere where they could actually build a much bigger site, and where they'd already had the World War One site, it was too hemmed in. One side by the railway line and the other side by the Great North Road running from London up to Edinburgh. So they found a site about a mile or so to the west, and it was ideal. It was kind of common grazing land. It was a little bit boggy in places, but not so much that it was going to defeat the builders, if you like. And they had an idea in 1941. I'm going back long before the airfield was actually constructed. But in sort of 1940, 1941, the RAF were going through a bit of a bad patch in terms of working out what they needed for bomber aircrew. When they started the war, they set up a collection of what they called bomber and gunnery schools, which, as the name suggests, were training sort of bomb aimers, but also gunners. Now, they weren't separate entities back then in the early days of the war. You found that a bomb aimer actually acted as a nose gunner in aircraft like the Vickers Wellington because they didn't have room for another crewman just purely and simply operating the nose guns. There was like an emergency situation. The bomb aimer would also man the nose turret. So it made sense to do the two roles in the same place. But when they got bigger aircraft involved, such as the Short Stirling and the Handley Page Halifax and the Avro Lancaster, these aircraft had another gun position on them. So they had the nose gun, but they had a tail gun position, but they also had what they called a mid-upper gun position, which was on the top of the fuselage behind the cockpit. So you're looking at another crewman, another purely gunner sort of position, which had to find more personnel. And bombing and gunnery schools just couldn't cut it. They couldn't put enough people through the program. And of course, they were training people who were doing two roles, whereas they needed pure gunners. So in about 1941, June 41 or so, they scrapped the bombing and gunnery schools, sent them back to sort of a previous life, if you like, a different unit, but then created what they called air gunner schools, not air gunnery schools, but air gunner schools. And the first three were set up on the West Coast. One was set up in South Wales. Another one was set up somewhere else in the West of England. And they tried to set up a third one in Cumbria, which is on the northwest coast of England. It took a bit of time. It was a bit delayed. The fourth one, number four air gunner school, was earmarked for Morpeth when they finally got around to building the airfield. And construction started in midway through 1941. And it wasn't until early 1942 when the airfield was actually ready for the first aircraft to arrive and the gunnery school to actually start operating.
What were the makeup of the students then, Graham? Where were they coming from? Were they coming for particularly for bomber commands? Were they coming for from abroad? What sort of makeup of the students was?
The makeup of the intakes, if you like, for each course. I mean, basically, they would take anybody they could get because manpower was a real problem. They were desperate to get as many gunners through the school as possible to train them up. So you had not only British people, but you had people from the occupied countries, such as Czechoslovakia, Poland, but you also had French, Norwegian, Dutch, people coming through, some Canadians, New Zealanders, you know, you name it. Anywhere where you saw, you know, aircrew were coming from fighting with the RAF, they were going, they would end up through Morpeth as well. And you mentioned Bomber Command, but also Coastal Command. Some of the gunners would be hived off to fill roles on Coastal Command squadrons, some like the short Sunderland, which again was an aircraft which had a nose gun, a tail gun, and a mid-upper. So there were other aircraft that needed extra manpower, and some no doubt were diverted off to Coastal Command. But yes, the majority of the people who went through the training regime at Morpeth went to direct to Bomber Command.
And what aircraft types were they training on? And also, where did the pilots and the other air crew come from to fly these missions?
So the aircraft themselves, because Morpeth was a training school, it didn't have a priority in terms of aircraft coming fresh off the from the manufacturers, you know, brand new. They were basically sort of saddled with what like cast-offs. And one particular aircraft got a reputation, and it was the Blackburn Bother, which was a twin-engine aircraft. It was quite underpowered, and it was designed primarily as a torpedo bomber and maritime reconnaissance aircraft. But it only ever equipped one squadron, number 608 squadron, down at Thornaby near Middlesbrough in northern England. And it wasn't a real success. It was underpowered. It had a very poor view from the cockpit because it had shoulder-mounted wings with engines very close to the fuselage, and the pilot couldn't really see too much behind him. It was very poorly built and laid out. But because they had sufficient aircraft and they had plenty of hours on them left on the airframes and on the engines, they were considered quite, you know, sort of useful to try and put into a secondary role like air gunnery instruction. And aircraft started arriving at Morpeth in early April 1942 for use with a squadron. The air gunner school actually opened on the 17th of April 1942. And they had about eight of these Bothas had turned up by then. They would have many more. They had about 30 to 40 aircraft all told of this type. But in the first few days, they had just a handful of aircraft to work with. In terms of target tugs, because they had an air-to-air firing range in the North Sea, just off the Northumberland coast, probably about 15 odd miles to the northeast of the airfield, a place called Druridge Bay, which was an air-to-air firing range. They had to have aircraft to pull drogue targets for air-to-air firing. And again, they had cast-offs in the shape of the Westland Lysander, which had been an army cooperation aircraft, which had been served in the Battle of France. And then also gained a good reputation for delivering secret agents, if you like, into occupied France.
Yeah.
But it also had another role in that of a target tug. So some of them were converted to pull drogues. And there was a handful of those aircraft were based at Morpeth as well. And that's the Bothas and the Lysanders soldiered on until midway through 1943, when it was decided that they were too long in the tooth and they were going to get new aircraft. But come on to that a bit later. But in terms of the makeup of the pilots, again, you'll find that they come from all over the globe. There were a lot of Poles who were flying at Morpeth. The senior Polish pilot was 46 years old, but there were others. There was a New Zealand pilots. There were, you know, pilots from Canada. There were pilots from all over. It was quite a cosmopolitan makeup, not only of the trainees, but also of the pilots and the ground staff and everybody else there.
And what was the impact of that sort of multicultural crew makeup on the local population? Did they integrate well? Did they get involved with the local cultures and population?
certainly the made an impact, because obviously a lot of, I guess, foreign people, if you like, to use a horrible phrase, descending on a fairly quiet part of Northumberland, it must have been a bit of a culture shock for some of the locals. Having said that, a lot of the Polish people who served at Morpeth settled in the area after the war. So was quite a, you know, quite an influx of people from Poland who, for one reason or another, couldn't go back home after hostilities, and they, you know, they were forced to stay in the UK, but they chose that part of England to live in and to settle and to marry and to raise families. So yes, you know, there was integration. There would have been dances and there would have been other social functions for all the airmen, you know, wherever they were from, to get involved in. And you know, there would have been a bit of a language barrier maybe, but not so much as to hinder, you know, people getting to know each other. So, and there doesn't seem to be any real, you know, sort of word of any problems between the various countries and people and the locals. It just seems to be something where, you know, they were well liked. You know, people got on with them and they didn't integrate. There were parades in the local town. You know, the air cadets from all over the northeast of England, from Newcastle and from other towns in the southeast of Northumberland, went to annual camps at RAF Morpeth during the summer of each year. And, you know, got to know some of the people there and got some trips on the airplanes and this kind of thing, even while the war was going on. So there was definitely some, you know, sort of integration and some really, really good activities going on.
Yeah. Was the base ever threatened by the Germans coming across the North Sea? We know we were very active going the other way, particularly with our coastal command strike squadrons during the mid and end of the war. Was there any reciprocal activity from the Germans coming across?
Well, certainly the powers that be, when they set the airfield up, they allocated defence units to the airfield even while it was being constructed. They blocked the runways with obstacles while they were being constructed, just in case the Germans decided to land, you know, gliders full of troops or parachute people onto the base. They had a battle HQ, which was standard practice for all airfields, as a remote site to conduct the defence of an airfield should it become under attack. They had anti-aircraft positions there. But as your question, you know, no, it was never directly threatened. There were never any, as far as I'm aware, there were never any bombing sort of raids on the airfield. There were bombs that landed around the area different times during 1940 and 1941, but no specific attacks on the aerodrome itself. The Germans simply weren't able to mount those kind of attacks from 1942 to the end of the war in the northeast of England. There were isolated reconnaissance flights and some other raids, but there were nothing on the scope, you know, that seen during the dark days of 1940.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Graham, why don't you give us a flavour for the activity of the airfield then? We know there were several incidents. Obviously, training flights always have a slightly higher risk of accident and incident than maybe more qualified pilots and instructors. There was one particular incident that seems to be quite noteworthy of two Bofors coming together. What happened during those training operations?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll give you a quick rundown of what the training involved before I go on to that specific crash, which happened in March 1943. In terms of the training, the intended, the, the training course for the gunners would be 6 weeks. And there was ground instruction first. So they got to know how to operate the machine guns and strip them down and load them and all the rest of it. And then they were taken out onto the airfield and there would be gun butts set up where they could basically fire the machine guns at the sand sort of stacked up against these big brick walls, which two of the gun butts still survive on the airfield, by the way. And then there would be a dummy turret, which would be sitting on the back of a vehicle, which again, they could climb into and they could operate the controls. So they'd learn that way. And then as time went on, they were actually, they were into the aircraft and then sent to the air-to-air firing range off the coast of Northumberland, and they would fire at the drones, And each aircraft would carry maybe three trainees at a time because it was impossible to just take them up one at a time. It was, you know, a bit of a rush, if you like, to try and get these men trained. And each of the trainees would have a kind of, you know, machine gun belts with the ammunition in them, and each of the belts had a different color painted on the tips of the bullets. So when they brought the drogue back to base, they could see which of the trainees had you know, struck the target, and where. So they could count the scores and they could work out accuracy for the gunners. And accuracy in terms of figures and percentages was really, you know, that was a thing that they kept striving for, much better and better, better accuracy. It actually works out that something that it was like 15%. Of bullets fired hit the target, which sounds really low, but actually that was a good average.
It was
quite low. But then they talk about accuracy figures, and then when you see the official records, they're looking at the 70s and 80s, if you like, in terms of overall accuracy, which they're right. quite happy with. That doesn't mean to say they actually hit the target 70% 80% of the time. It just means that the figures were kind of manipulated in terms of some other things as well that went on, but they were happy with that. Some aircrew, some trainees were washed out of the course for various reasons. Some were disciplinary reasons, some because they simply couldn't sort of operate the machine guns properly, others failed exams and ground lectures and things like that, and some were so airsick when they started flying that they couldn't operate the guns properly, and they were just they were washed out on medical reasons. So there's all sorts of things like that happened, but after the 6 weeks, and actually that was reduced by a week or so at certain times when they needed like a big influx of aircrew, but it was mostly 6 weeks. Then they got sent off to the operational units, the training units, like a heavy conversion unit or some of the operational training units, which dealt with putting bomber crews together before they went to an operational squadron, because they didn't go straight to a squadron from the gunnery training school. There was an intermediate stage again before they went to the front line. Now, in terms of the March 1943 incident that you mentioned about the two Bothas hitting each other in midair, yeah, that was a major incident. And it's still talked about occasionally in Morpeth. People, they may not remember it per se, but the actual people who were friends and relatives remember it vividly in terms of the aftermath. There was the funerals in the town. The graves are still in the local cemetery, so you can see all the gravestones of everybody that perished in the collision. And basically, the story is that there was an official visit that day from the head of the Flying Training Command. He was an Air Vice Marshal, Sir Philip Babington, and he was on an official visit with also the head of 29 Training Group, which was they looked after for Number 4 Air Gunner School. So it was it wasn't just an ordinary visit. It was something special. And even though the weather wasn't that good, for some reason, there was an order given to send two aircraft up into the air. Now, whether that came from the Air Vice Marshal or it was, or it was the squad, the unit themselves thinking, well, we should really try and make an effort to try and impress him. Nobody knows. However, these two aircraft went up, and one aircraft had the 46-year-old Polish pilot called Flight Lieutenant Zarski. He was a senior Polish pilot at Morpeth. And on board his aircraft, there were three trainees from Number 24 course at the Gunner School. One was British and two were Dutch. They were actually Dutch Navy, Dutch Naval Air Service, as it were. And there was also and this isn't reported everywhere, but there was a fifth person on board as well. And he was from a Polish replacement bureau, a kind of holding unit for aircrew who hadn't been assigned to units. And for some reason, he'd wangled a flight. It's not entirely clear about why he was on board, but he certainly was. And then the other aircraft had a 22-year-old New Zealander called George Jackson at the controls. He had an instructor on board who was a British, and three Dutch trainees, again, from the Naval Air Service. And for some reason, at about 11:45, the two aircraft collided with each other in the circuit at about 1,200 feet, about maybe 2 miles east of the aerodrome, so towards the Great North Road. And they were both returning to Morpeth at the time. Now, the official crash records suggest that that the New Zealander hadn't kept a good lookout when you know, when he was flying and had flown into their aircraft. It's not entirely clear what happened. You'll probably understand that a lot of the wartime records actually do, you know, sort of apportion blame quite a lot of the time, especially when there were deaths, because there's no, you know, there's no kind of counter argument, if you like. But that's the story. And all 10 on board the two aircraft died. So it was
very sad.
It was horrific. There was one of the air crew and tried to parachute out, but his parachute didn't open correctly, and he was killed. There were you know, some fairly large funerals, and a lot of the people from the town recall, you know, these big processions as they took the bodies up to the graveyard to be buried. And of course, number 24 course had lost six trainees. One British and five Dutch. So it was a huge blow for that particular course. And of course, the Bomber Command and the Dutch Naval Air Service lost potential gunners.
Yeah, very sad. Very sad. Did were there any other significant incidents? I mean, when I was studying the airfield, that seems to be the one that comes up the most. There was other activity there, though, as well, wasn't there?
There were lots of incidents. Even before that, they'd lost both us and they'd lost Lysanders in various training flight accidents. There'd been various things over the air ranges where aircraft had gone into the sea as well. There's too many to recall here. But there was another element as well, because where Morpeth was situated, it was ideally placed for personnel from the station to be sent out over into the hills to attend crashes from other units, other squadrons from up and down the country. And bearing in mind the border hills saw its fair share of crashes. Sometimes in bad weather, aircraft flying into hills through cloud and just crashing at the side of a mountain or a hill. Back about 20 years ago, I compiled the list of military aircraft crashes from 1914 up until 2000, and I was well over 500 incidents by the time I stopped looking.
So it was quite a lot.
And that's just in Newfoundland. So there's one particular case which happened in 1944. There's a Lancaster crashed up near a place called Otterburn, which is right up in the hills, right in the far northwest, up near the Scottish border. And the present day military training area takes its name from Otterburn, from the local village. And up near the road up there, this Lancaster crashed one night, and wreckage was strewn over about a mile. The tail unit was somewhere, the engines went somewhere else, and the rest of the aircraft, you know, landed somewhere else as well. But Morpeth was the nearest place, and quite a few personnel were sent up in trucks, including several, you know, medical personnel. And their job was to not only sort of like, you know, hunt through the wreckage and try and find people who may be still alive, but also to piece the wreckage together and collect it to bring it back for salvage and for examination, etc. So, and it wasn't the only one they attended. They attended some which were much nearer as well. There was a Wellington for a training unit crashed near the base at Morpeth, a couple of miles to the north. And again, the personnel had to go out and attend to the wreckage and obviously keep onlookers away from the aircraft, from the wreckage and the bodies and all the rest of it. So, yeah, they were quite busy. If there weren't accidents happening at the aerodrome, they were also involved in ones that were in the area.
Yeah. And that, of course, is all in the book. Yes. Graham, one thing I wanted to ask is, did any of the trainees go on and find success, particularly notable success, with the RAF and maybe some of those bomber squadrons, or any of them picked up for any particular notification elsewhere?
So It's hard actually find it to trace a lot of people because there were so many trainees went through, and for the courses you don't actually see the names of many of the trainees in the records from the base. There are occasional notes about people who moved on and did other things. One of the pilots who flew the training aircraft at Morpeth actually was transferred to what they call the Raffwaffe, the enemy recognition flight that was based at Colley Weston down in the south of England. And he returned to Morpeth with a captured Junkers 88, believe it or not, in late 1944, before the base shut, just to show it off to they were showing off the aircraft to the trainees. Look, you know, this is what you might be up against if you do 88s, were not just bombers, but there were night fighters as well. It had a Spitfire escort, of course, when it landed. So he came back to show this aircraft off to the locals, if you like. So, that was a big thing.
Great. What happened towards the end of the war to Morpeth then?
Yeah. So we get to course number 70, I believe it was, and this was beginning of December 1944, and the airfield was closed. They didn't need so many. The writing was on the wall for Germany by then. It was only a matter of when, not if, the war would end. And it was conceivable that that would be sooner rather than later. So they didn't need as many air gunner schools. There was something like 10 or 11 in Britain at the height of the war. But by the end of 1944, they didn't need as many aircrew. So therefore, what they did was they closed the school, and the people who were still on number 70 course, which was halfway through when they closed it on the 9th of December 1944, they transferred them to a place called Castle Kennedy, which is over near Stranraer, which is in southwest Scotland, where the ferry to Northern Ireland goes from. So in much like a backwater of the war, if you like, and they continue to train a smaller amount of gunners each month there because they were still needing them for bombers right until the end of the war. But Morpeth basically had outlived its usefulness, if you like. And it was mothballed. It was put into what they call care and maintenance. So there was a small working party were assigned to the airfield. And all they did was just make sure that the runways were clear to be used if they ever needed to be. And that some of the more important buildings, such as the control tower and some of the hangars, were kept in reasonable shape. And the rest of the airfield was left to basically just sort of rot away.
That's sad. And you mentioned earlier the potential state of it now. What still remains of it?
Well, I guess just before I do that, there's one last story to tell about the RAF.
Oh, go on then.
Yeah, so it's all right. There was a little swan song, if you like. So in April 1945, there was a French Spitfire unit turned up. So it had been the airfield had been mothballed for a few months. Yes, In late 1944, the French senior French Air Force, Free French Air Force, that is, people in Britain thought that they wanted their own operational training unit to train Spitfire pilots. Previously to that, they'd gone through the RAF system of going through elementary training and then going to what they called an operational training unit, which was where they were shown what squadron practices would be like. And they were shown how to fly in formation and aerobatics and air-to-ground firing and all this kind of thing. And the idea was that they would do it, but purely through a French basis from start to finish. So they thought they would set up this unit. It was called Number 80 Operational Training Unit. And it wasn't established until April 1945, and they decided to do it at Morpeth. So it only lasted until July, and then they moved it to Euston, which was another airfield in Northumberland, about 15 to 20 miles to the west of Newcastle, next to the Roman Wall. But it was in Morpeth for a few months while it started. And the person who led it was a guy called Christian Martel, except that wasn't his real name. He was actually called Philip Montet. But a lot of French fighter pilots at that time had aliases because their families were still living in what was occupied Europe. They did that to prevent possible reprisals by the Germans. So he actually died, unfortunately, in a training accident at Euston just after they left Morpeth. But there was quite a few French Spitfires operating out of Morpeth for about 4 months. But there's very few records, unfortunately. I have been able to find is in the book, but there's very little on what happened at that time in the war.
Right, interesting stuff. Yeah, I'd forgotten that one. Sorry about that. That was a really interesting one.
Yeah, and one final bit before the airfield does finally shut down. Number 261 maintenance unit, right at the end of the war. So you're talking about June 1945-ish. It sets up to basically act as a holding and a kind of collection center for all the spare equipment, office equipment, if you like, from that up to tools right. and everything else.
Yeah.
Was a kind of like a dumping ground for all the airfields in Northumberland and in that part of the Northeast.
Yeah.
And they just basically just brought it all to Morpeth. Anything that they couldn't salvage, anything they couldn't move on to a different station, anything they couldn't sell on, just got put, you know, just got dumped in Morpeth. And they used it as a storage area. And that lasted until about 1948 or so. So there were some transport aircraft coming and going. One person I used to know actually recalls a Dakota landing sometime in the late 1940s. But that was it, you know, that was basically that winding down, if you like. And by the end of 1948, it was shut for flying entirely.
Yeah, yeah. Very sad. Very sad. Was there no opportunity for general aviation to use the airfield maybe in later years?
Yeah, there was. Some people actually set up a gliding club there. It was called the Newcastle Gliding Club, and there was a three or four gliders based there. But it didn't last very long, and they moved elsewhere. And that was probably in the late 40s, early 1950s. But there was no, I think there was probably no, it was, you're looking at austerity Britain, there was probably no money to spend on that kind of thing. And already down the road at what was called Woolsington Airfield near Newcastle, which had been an RAF base during the war, it was starting to be used as Newcastle's municipal airport. So a lot of private flying started there as well. So the focus had moved for any opportunity that they could have had to actually open Morpeth as a place for recreational flying had long gone by then.
Very sad. So one final question on Morpeth then, Graham. What would you say RAF Morpeth's legacy is today?
Well, its legacy is basically to help Bomber Command with, you know, the throughput of gunners. Gunners were desperately needed by the service. From day one, and without those, you know, trained personnel, they would have had lots more aircraft would have been shot down or just not there in the first place. It was a fairly unsung, if you like, part of Bomber Command, and not one that people know about, but desperately important to the success of their overall mission.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Let me just bring in then the wider Northumberland area. You've got 3 books on Northumberland aviation stories. Fabulous little group of books. Just before we go, can you maybe give us some a bit of a taster from some of those, Graham?
Yeah, so and they're all actually, there's a compilation volume as well of all 3, so people can pick and choose. They're basically just a collection of stories from early ballooning experiments in the late 1700s, believe it or not, right through to almost like sort of about 2000-ish. Just various stories about civilian but also military aircraft. So there's stories about crashes, about early experiments with radio technology, and also much more, maybe more well-known things about so-called Black Thursday, which was when the Luftwaffe tried to attack northeastern England on the 15th of September, August 1940, sorry. And that went particularly awry for them. So the story you know, the stories about all these type of things and some other bits and pieces as well. There's a story about a strange tale of an Austrian registered aircraft that crashed near Newcastle Airport in the late 1980s. And some of the documentation on board was very strange. So there's some weird and wonderful tales involved in those books.
And do you have a favourite at all?
Yeah, there's one where my wife and I actually went walking into the hills up in the Kielder Forest, which is this huge, huge area of forest up near the Scottish border, to look for the wreck of a Halifax. And it was 3 miles away you had to walk. So it's a story of basically finding this wreckage deep in the forest, and it's all there still. Wouldn't know where it was unless you've done the research to find it, first of all. So it was a quite major expedition to go up there and find it, take pictures of it and come back. And that record, I first saw it back in 2013 or something, and it's still there. But people had seen it on the hillside as early as the 1970s, and it crashed in 1944. So it's just an example of the many crashes in this particular area. And there are stories of various other crashes in the books. But there's also stories of German aircraft crashing as well, some civilian aircraft, some post-war ones that are crashed, and just a whole lot of other things as well. So, yeah, there's something for everybody, I think, in that, hopefully.
Fabulous roundup of stories from that part of the world, and something, as I started off suggesting, is not covered a great deal elsewhere. So really grateful for you capturing those stories. Where can we find the books? Where can listeners get hold of a copy, Graham?
So the easiest way probably is just to search for my name on Amazon, Graham Rendell, and you'll see them all come up on there, and that's where they're sold through. So yeah, that's the way to find them. And if people want to look at my website, which is rivercountrybooks.com, that's Reva spelled R-E-I-V-E-R-S, and Country Books all one word. There's also links to the various books on the website.
Okay, Graham, we haven't had time today to do this, but I still want to have a chat with you about that trip you made to the Soviet Union. So will you come back and do that for us sometime?
Yeah, the trip to Northeast Siberia. Oh, yeah, definitely. I'd love to talk to you about that, yeah.
And then finally then, Graham, where can we find you online?
So I'm mostly active on Twitter, which is at Borders750. So that's where people can find me. But the website I mentioned there, rivercountrybooks.com, you can find me there as well.
All right, Graham, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter. Thanks again for the invitation. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, if you'd like to support the programme, we welcome listener donations. If you want to make a regular or one-off donation, and only again if you can afford it, go and see the donate button on our website. If you don't want to do that, but you want to give us a review, we'd really appreciate that on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Remember to follow Event Fire Solutions on Twitter, EMFS999. And also Mick at the Aviation Historian for his ongoing support. That's it. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Ellie, Gareth and Tim on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. So look us up there. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Graham.
Bye-bye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station. Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.